Hi, it's Mark Bittman. Welcome to Food. As always, you can email us at food@markbittman.com. We're happy to respond. We'd love to hear anything you say, seriously. And please subscribe to the podcast and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Say wonderful things about us. And please also subscribe to The Bittman Project, our thrice weekly newsletter, which you can find at bittmanproject.com, which, like this podcast, gets better and better all the time. Okay, back in a minute.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. It's an interesting conversation today, and I think it's going to lead to an equally interesting follow-up. But this is with Chef Edward Lee and his business partner, Lindsay, off Sasek. And they have been working on a nonprofit relief food program since the beginning of COVID and even before. They've worked on labor issues. They've worked on a number of things to make restaurant models better. But their idea now is to do a nonprofit that will demonstrate a number of things about the restaurant business and ways to make things move forward, ways from treatment of labor to elevation of women to the way energy is used in restaurants, electricity instead of gas, for example, the use of single-use plastics. All of these things we'll talk about. So really what we're going to talk about is how a nonprofit restaurant operation might do things better and what that can demonstrate. There are some unique aspects to what they're doing, and they're fascinating and worth listening to. It's not entirely coincidental that I'm working on a not-for-profit restaurant model. I've talked about it a little bit, and we've written about it in the newsletter some. tentatively called Community Kitchen, and we don't really talk about that much here. And one of our ideas at the end of this conversation is for Lindsay and Edward to come back and interview me. So that might be happening. Something will happen. Something interesting will happen. But something interesting already has happened, and it's this conversation. So here we go. I just wonder if it might make sense to talk a little bit about each of your histories and to talk some about the work that the Lee Initiative has done already.
I'm the chef part of this duo. Gosh, I've been in Louisville, Kentucky now 21 years, started with 610 Magnolia, and, you know, just ran a fine dining restaurant forever. Lindsay was actually my GM and sommelier for many years, and we got to a crossroads where she, you know, was in a place in her life where she didn't want to work the grueling hours and work in the evenings, and I didn't want to lose her as part of the team. So we sat down one day and we said, well, what do we do? Like, so how do we retain the culture and you know, retain your expertise while you don't have to work nights? And she kind of hit upon this idea of doing a nonprofit. And it was about that time when really the Me Too movement just sort of came down the pipeline and obviously like had huge ramifications for the restaurant world. And that kind of was our first, you know, spark of inspiration where we're like, okay, this is something that's both terrible for the restaurant industry and also an opportunity for us to do something different, to do something that's impactful, to really change things. And, you know, I'll let Lindsay take it from there. But basically this whole idea, the original part of Lee Initiative was her brainchild.
So like Edward said, I was working for him as the GM and some for 610 whenever the Me Too movement was hitting our industry very hard. Those stories were extremely important and they needed to be brought to light. But we had, like Edward said, we had so many conversations about why this was happening in the industry, what was being said. And honestly, taking a deep dive on, you know, I was a woman who was in a leadership role within restaurants. What was different for me, because that was not my experience. And we landed on the fact that I had mostly worked for women. And so we created the Lee Initiative as a mentorship program for women to rise the ranks within the industry. You know, typically the staging system, it works for one very small group of people that can afford to move to New York or Paris and work for free for a year. And so we reached out to women who had risen the ranks from line cooks to owning many restaurants and award-winning chefs and asked them if they would be willing to mentor young women if we would cover the cost. And no one said anything but yes, and we're extremely enthusiastic.
So you sort of tested the idea. Everybody said yeah. And then you went out with that idea and fundraised so that you could actually support that program?
Yeah, we started with a very small amount of money, having a dinner party and asking people to support and, you know, went on a prayer that it would work out. And it did. So with the women who have gone through the program, we put out a call to applicants. You know, we selected 5 women the first year and we were able to cover them going and staging and working with different chefs across the country, not only sending them and covering their lodging and their travel, but also covering their wages while they were gone to continue their education. Because, you know, a lot of people can't take off work for 2 weeks and you should reserve your PTO for when you actually need it. So again, a very small program for 3 years. Then 2020 happened. At that point, we pivoted into direct aid and were able to open relief kitchens in 21 cities across the country. So Maker's Mark and Beam Suntory were our big partners in the Women in Culinary and Spirits program. You know, the mentees were actually here. We do a week in Kentucky and they were at the distillery whenever every restaurant in the country started to close. All of them had gotten calls that, you know, they were furloughed. And so we reached out to our partners and they immediately, you know, went to looking at their budgets to see how they could help support opening these relief kitchens. We opened one in Louisville, Kentucky first. I think it was 2 days after the shutdown and caused a traffic jam. It was, you know, a lot of people were coming. And so our partners were able to take their marketing budgets that had been set for the year to do cash infusions into restaurants. And we set up portals for them to raise money in their own communities. And we would send that every week to keep people employed just to do meals. And then they all had small groceries with diapers, formula, like needs that they had.
Right. So, right. That's a terrific story. Did it go beyond Louisville or that was the...
Yeah, we were in 21 cities within the second week of the pandemic.
We were in Seattle, LA with Nancy Silverton, Chicago with Paul Kahan. I mean, we did Atlanta, Dallas, Houston with Ryan LaShane. I mean, it was a long list of...
Yeah, essentially, it was dictated by where there were marketing dollars to be had. We could go to chefs that we had worked with in the past in those regions and start doing cash infusions to keep them open.
That's a great story.
We actually took the program one step further, and what we did was, once we realized that the chefs were not buying ingredients, that all of these chefs that we talked to were not buying those lovely organic farm-to-table ingredients from the farms. And I visited a couple of farms in the region here and saw hundreds of pounds of produce just going to the trash bin. And so because, a lot of these farms rely on restaurants, and basically we realized that independent farms and independent restaurants are two sides of the same house. And so we started a program in the middle of all that to buy all the excess produce, some meats, some dairies, cheeses from farms that were in dire straits. And then we would donate those products to the chefs that were doing relief. And again, it was just like this whole system that we created. And that saved, I don't know how many farms we saved, but there was a number of independent small farms that just wrote letters and called us and said, we would not have made it without you guys.
And yeah, I mean, that program was near and dear to all of our hearts. When we reached out to our partners, restaurateurs have these long-standing relationships with farms, and they felt awful that they were not purchasing from them, especially if they had contracted them to grow X amount of things. So we were able to bridge that gap. I'm sure you can imagine how interesting the conversations were to call a farm and say, if I send you $25,000 to create a credit, will you send produce to these people or meats or whatever it was? But we just had an event in Chicago with one of the restaurants that we worked with. And, they still 3 years later have this long lasting relationship with their protein farmer where they're purchasing from them year round. And so it was twofold, like, one, bridge the gap for folks that were already purchasing, but then also to introduce restaurants in that region that may or may not have been working with small farms. And we've seen a continued relationship, which was really important to us.
And the third part of that is, one thing that we did with these, donated meals or free meals is we wanted to take the stigma out of accepting a free meal. And so these were not, these meals were not out of a can. They were not like potatoes come from powder. These were all very nice chef-driven meals. And one of the things that we had was like, if I wouldn't feed this to my family, I don't want any of these meals going out to people. Because just because you're in need, it doesn't mean you get a lower quality meal. And that's the one thing that was very important to us throughout this process, that, the meals were simple. Sometimes you just get a roast chicken and haricot vert and mashed potatoes. They had to be made with real ingredients. They had to be fresh, nothing processed, and, like real chef-driven food.
Yeah, that's great. And the distribution was through the restaurants?
Yeah.
I wish we had done this part of the podcast 2 years ago, because that is a really great story. There are a lot of good stories about people who've formalized support of farmers during COVID in ways that they hadn't before. So nonprofits springing up to pay farmers to grow food directly or established nonprofits deciding to pay farmers to grow food directly for the emergency food system. Other things like that.
When I feel like people connected, farmers markets and CSAs exploded during that time. Everyone realized how important it was to support the food system that will actually be sustainable in a crisis.
Yeah, I think we learned, well, those of us who are open to learning something, learn something. I don't know what the long-term implications are, but we can only hope that they're good. So, and how long did that, you must have stopped at some point or not?
With those programs, so they were phased out. I mean, it was late 2021. You know, restaurants had been open for several months, and we exhausted all of our resources that we could into those programs. You know, and there were other parts of it. We had, you know, this is when we learned really to always reach out to a corporation and ask for help if you can. You know, we were able to bridge transportation gaps for farmers through our partnership with Audi. The things that we were able to do just by reaching out and asking was incredible. You know, American Airlines hubs all over the country, we had yogurt and fresh pressed juice and the things that were going to be thrown away. It's when we really learn to just ask and someone will probably help you.
How many corporate partners would you say you had?
Through Relief, probably 20 or 30. You know, and some of them came in at different levels, but you know, marketing budgets are set a year ahead of time. No one knew what was going to happen. And they were very willing to help and support us. And a lot of those partners have stayed on because they saw the impact that we were able to make, you know, by reacting quickly to what was happening and then, you know, move forward.
So they've stayed on to be supporters of the new nonprofit restaurant?
Yeah, some of them have, or just stayed on to be supporters, you know, through the Women Culinary and Spirits Program, which directly, the mentorship program that we spoke about, directly feeds into the restaurant that we're starting. So they all have a small piece of the puzzle. You know, Maker's Mark and Beam Suntory, they are an alcohol brand, so we have a liquor license and they cannot support directly to that program, but they can support our overall infrastructure.
And what we looked at was like, what is the crisis now restaurants are facing? Right. Because it's not, everyone thinks the world went back to normal and restaurants reopened and, you know, we're all good now. And we're not. You know, the fact is, like, the in many ways, the system is not working. And the perception of what restaurants are inaccurate. And how restaurants are going to survive in the next generation is still a big question mark. And so part of, you know, segueing out of Relief and into what the next phase of the Lee Initiative is going to be is how we ended up on the idea of doing this think tank nonprofit restaurant, where we're going to take this time, it's a 5-year project, we're going to take this time, invest money, figure out what are the problems that face, that restaurants face, independent restaurants, how do restaurants become more sustainable? In a real sense, not just using catchphrases and, you know, discard, getting rid of plastic straws. Like, how do we really make impacts? Like, what does the restaurant of the future look like? Can it pay fair wages? Can it do all the things that the public is asking us to do? And can it be done and still run a business? And that's part of what we're trying to figure out with this restaurant. And you know, Lindsay can talk about the research and the partners that we have. It's a big project, but we're also trying to figure out, like, can we help independent restaurants survive whatever this next decade looks like by doing this research, putting the financial burden on our backs, doing the research, and then publishing the papers for free so that everyone can look at it and you have real data. You have real conclusions. You have real sort of, you know, formulas to look like. You have a roadmap, a blueprint. And so if you want to go do an electric kitchen, here's how it works. Here's the exact cost. Here's your pitfalls. Here's your advantages. Here's your disadvantages. Now you can decide. And if you want to go 50% electric, that's fine. If you want to go 20%, that's fine. Like, we're not casting judgment. We're just saying, this is what it takes to do this. Now you can decide for yourself. And I think that's the one thing that so many restaurants are, you know, every restaurant I talk to, every chef I talk to, they want to do good. They want to do the right thing. They don't have the money, the resources, the time, the energy. They don't know where to start. You know, no one wants to be the first one through the door because first person always gets, you know, they always end up spending more money and it doesn't. So, like, we're going to be the first ones. We're going to make all the mistakes. We're going to figure out what all the pitfalls are. And we will publish. We'll publish both our successes and our failures, and let it just be completely transparent about how we can do and implement all these initiatives that everyone wants to see restaurants do. But is it feasible?
Right. Stay tuned for more from me, Lindsay, and Edward right after this break. Let me take this opportunity to also remind you about Food Print director Jerusha Klemperer's excellent reporting on that organization's podcast, What You're Eating, specifically the recent episode, PFAS, the Forever Chemicals in Food. I talked with Jerusha about these toxins, and I was amazed, fascinated, horrified. PFAS are in everything from your paper straws to your raincoat to your medical devices. And in Jerusha's report, you'll hear interviews with farmers who have been deeply affected by these chemicals. You can find the episode on foodprint.org, foodprint.org. Back in a sec.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the Multi-Terrain Select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Hi, folks. We have a new sponsor and an interesting one. We all take about 20,000 breaths a day, and Americans spend about 90% of our time indoors. That indoor air that we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. And indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So, what's the solution? Introducing Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code BITMAN, B-I-T-T-M-A-N, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to our listeners, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. That's AirDoctorPro.com and use the promo code BITMAN. I think your fundamental question, I read it in one of your docs, was what do restaurants look like in a setting of responsibility and equity? There are many interesting things to unpack in that, but you're starting a nonprofit, or you're enhancing your existing nonprofit, starting a project that's a nonprofit in order to help for-profits, or maybe hopefully for-profits, since everybody knows the margins in restaurants are pretty slim. But let's talk about labor for a minute. And I know some of the relief stuff had to do with restaurant workers also. We are in a different world, and we all remember the fight for 15, which sort of began 10 years ago or so. But $15 net doesn't any longer sound like much of an improvement to anybody. What does equity mean when it comes to labor in the restaurant industry?
I mean, for me, one of the most interesting parts of this project and what part of what led to it was, you know, like I said, every restaurant that we approached to open a relief kitchen, they had been feeding people in their community all along. We were able to help fund that. You know, now that we're out of COVID or whatever we're calling it now, you know, restaurateurs are also dealing with the wage models that are changing rapidly. They're also dealing with labor shortages. So how do we look at utilizing a nonprofit arm for for-profit businesses to do the community work that they have done all along? And it's like when you meet a restaurateur who's like, oh, I can't do that this year because we literally don't have the staff to pay overtime and all of these things, it's impossible for them, but it's also heartbreaking to watch because it is a part of their ethos and they are a part of the community that they're in. And that's extremely important. So we have to look at new models for doing that. With our restaurant project, we have met with One Fair Wage, the IRC, Independent Restaurant Coalition. How do we look at what policies are currently in place, what is coming down the pipeline, and make sure that we are paying folks a living wage? But more than that, if your fine dining restaurant is going to be a part of the community, yes, you're going to have overtime paying folks to help support these feeding initiatives, to be a part of the community. So how do you financially do that in this current moment? And we sort of disagree on this, but I can't see how it's feasible without a nonprofit arm for your restaurant.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that, you know, when we look at the labor model and we publish our papers on it, being completely transparent about what works and what doesn't, we all have to understand whether you're in media or you're a restaurateur or chef, like, there is nuance to this that often gets missed. And when people say fight for 15, I'm like, yeah, that's great. You know, but what are you talking about a waiter? Are you talking about a dishwasher? Are you talking about fast food? Are you talking about fine dining? Like 15 in West Virginia is very different than 15 in New York or San Francisco. You know, that regionally there's, you know, communities are different. Housing is different. There, you know, like in Louisville, Kentucky, you can find pretty decent housing for relatively inexpensive and within a bike ride to your place of work. It's not possible in San Francisco, you know. So these things take a lot of time to sort of break down and look at the proper investment for a future in this restaurant industry, right? So let's backtrack 30 years ago when I was making $6.50 an hour and not getting paid overtime and working in a restaurant in New York City for 80 hours, you know? Like, I knew I was being exploited, but I also understood that this was the education that I was getting and the amount of work it was just so important to my future that I was willing to invest in that towards my future. I think you're seeing now is that people aren't willing to put that investment time in because they don't see a future in the restaurant business. So, of course, if you're 22 now and you don't think this restaurant career is going to take you anywhere, or you don't think the restaurant business is going to survive or thrive in the next generation, why would you work for anything less than what you think you deserve on the upper echelon of that, you know, labor, you know, equity pay? So part of it is, yes, we're looking at equity, but the other part of it is, how do we put respect back into the restaurant industry? How do we put craft back into it? How do we put passion back into it, professionalism, you know, things like love and care and understanding that, like, what you do today could have an impact on your career 20 years from now. And I don't see that younger generations see. I don't think they see that. And part of that is our fault. Those of us who have been in this industry for the last 20, 30 years, we've not given them the space, the time, the respect, and given them a vision for the future. So part of it is that we also have to create the space so that they feel like they are part of this restaurant industry and not just cogs in a wheel. You know, now how we do that, how we solve that, that's a much bigger issue. But, you know, if we can build a small model with this restaurant, I don't know, maybe it sparks some conversation and some ideas.
Well, and on that, to that end, for me, you know, how, yes, we want you to want to be a part of the restaurant community, but I want to see how restaurants can always be a part of the community that they're in. That is very important to me. How do we feed people in our neighborhoods? You can't just be a fine dining restaurant that comes in and no one in your neighborhood can afford to eat there. You know, and that's with this model that we're working on. It's, you know, yeah, we're going to do community meals and be a part of the community. That also helps us with waste reduction. It, you know, we already have chefs that are there. We have, you know, things from our farms that can't be used on the regular menu, but they are still really beautiful, great products. And we'll always stick with, I'm not going to serve you anything that I wouldn't serve my kids. You know, how do we combine those two things of community service, being a part of the community that you're in? It also makes your staff feel good. That was one of the biggest feedbacks we had after relief, is how much care people put into making these community meals.
You know that I'm questioning whether restaurants can ever make money and do the right thing at the same time. But you're trying to figure out if that's possible. I wonder if you have a vision of what a fine dining restaurant looks like 10 years from now that does treat its employees with dignity, produces a fair product for a fair price, actually makes a profit, sources from real farms, only cooks food that you'd want to eat, and so on.
You want to go?
We have different visions of how this happens.
So I think all three of us have different visions, but it's a cool, yeah.
It's, I mean, cool for stuff, me, it's, so. You know, yes, that the restaurant is a part of the community that it's in, that we are able to create real professional careers for folks. It's such a myth that, you know, restaurants are only a stepping stone industry. It's like, for a lot of women in newcomers, there's vast swaths of people that will be in the restaurant industry forever. Utilize that, empower them, let them be a part of their community. I financially can't figure it out without having a nonprofit arm. Edward has different views. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's yes, you can have a professional career, you can do service work, we can feed our community, and we can all work in a symbiotic bubble, but I'm also a hopeless optimist. So.
No, me too.
Well, I'm not an optimist. I'm a realist. And at the end of the day, there's a financial burden that has to be met. And, you know, fine dining restaurants are driven first and foremost by, you know, the art, the creation of it, the you know, taking this concept of food to the nth degree, like going overboard with it. It's fine. they're not always going to be profitable. Some of them are you know, playgrounds for billionaires. That's fine too. But, you know, one of the models that I always look at is, you know, every city that you go to in America has a concert venue that I don't know, has let's say they're playing a Taylor Swift concert, right? She doesn't need help. Then every city has a symphony orchestra, or they have a you know, a performing arts theater. None of those, or they have a museum that with great art in it. None of them exist without help from the community. They are all nonprofits. If a symphony orchestra had to exist on its own two legs with ticket sales, there wouldn't be a single symphony orchestra in the entire country. Is fine dining any different? There's a McDonald's on every corner. They make a ton of money. I'm sorry if I'm comparing McDonald's to Taylor Swift, but they don't need our help. Fine dining, if we believe in the art, if we believe that the art of culinary, really beautiful fine dining is in itself worth it for the art itself, then do we need it? And do we want it to continue to exist? And if there isn't a billionaire willing to fund it, can it exist in a nonprofit space? Just like your symphony orchestra does, just like your performing arts theater does. And that's something to look at, you know, and then like Lindsay says, you can focus on the art, you can get donations, you can have corporate partners, you can be a part of the community and still do your art. But you also have to like give back to the community and not exist in a bubble outside of your community, but, you know, be a part of it. And I don't know the answer. I don't know if that is feasible or not, but it's one model.
Right. You're addressing the model that you know the most about, which makes a great deal of sense.
Yeah. Well, and for me, it's, you know, yes, communities support the ballet. They're often in areas where people are not utilizing the ballet, but the ballet is also giving back. My kids took ballet classes that were very reduced from a very lovely company because they always do reduced rate classes for the community that they're in. So if we're going to look at restaurants as a model and support it like the arts, which I do believe is important to do, we have to give back to the community that we're in. So how do we model that to make sure we are a part of this community and we are valuable?
You know, we've researched every nonprofit restaurant in America, every single one in every state. And overwhelming majority are incredible causes, incredible thoughtfulness, really impactful places that are important. But if we're going to be honest, they're not places that you would bring your wife to for her birthday, right?
I mean, yeah. What I say is that I don't want to pretend I know everything, but just about every nonprofit restaurant that's happened in this country, either it cuts a corner somewhere. It either sources badly, it cooks badly.
Oh, there's mismatched silverware. There's no wine list. It's you know, but they're feel good restaurants, and so you go. Will you go three times? Yeah. Will you go four times? And so, really, I mean, the genesis of what we started talking about was when we started doing the research is, can we be a nonprofit restaurant but actually be a really good restaurant? Can we get a beard nom and still actually do work? Like, is that even possible? And the more we research it, it's like, well, it doesn't really exist. I mean, there are a few, Staple House in Atlanta being one of them. But, you know, we looked at this and said, and one of the things that we do share, we're both stubborn and we're both pig-headed. And so when we see this stuff and
you could say dedicated.
Dedicated. That's a nicer one. When we see this stuff and we go, well, it doesn't exist. And why doesn't it exist? And then, you know, we have 10 people telling us, well, it doesn't exist because you can't do it. And then we go, you really can't do it? And they go, no. We've had a lot of people already tell us it's not possible. So we go, all right. And that's when we start going behind the scenes. We go, well, let's show them. Let's show them it is possible. And I think that's, I think that's the genesis of, you know, everything else. Obviously we've done a lot of road mapping through it, but that was the genesis of it. It's like, wait a second, is this possible? And I don't know, the more we think it is.
Right. I think it's possible as a nonprofit, but we'll see. So, which brings me, I think, to my second to last question, which is that you've sort of put a cap on this as a five-year project. What happens at the end of 5 years? What do we know that we don't know now? What are the goals for the five-year plan? I know a lot of it is research, but a lot of it is practice too.
A lot of it is practice. You know, one of the things that we've, all the initiatives that we've always done at Lee Initiative is, you know, we don't want to change the world. We want to create, inspire, create roadmaps, blueprints, and let other people run with it. Right. So if this works and we can show it, and it doesn't, it's going to take 2 years or maybe three really to show you that it works. If it works, I don't want to open a chain of nonprofit restaurants. I want someone to, we will publish and be completely give you the entire roadmap. We'll give you our entire laptop. I want someone in Houston to do their own version of it. I want someone in Oakland to do their own version. Our thing is there is an expiration date to this, because at some point we will have either proven that it works or we will have been proven that it doesn't work. So there's nothing else to do after that point. At that point, we publish the papers, we give you the roadmap, you take over. We would love to see 20 different restaurateurs take this model and run with it, get inspired by it, and do it in their own way, in their own community, in different places. We're not going to do it. For me, that's the deadline or the expiration. We're going to go, listen, this is it. It's either going to prove, after 5 years, there's nothing that's going, well, next year it'll work. It didn't work in 5 years. Next year. No, it's either going to work or it's not going to work. And we don't need 10 years to prove that.
But what does working look like?
Working looks like a successful restaurant that people want to eat at, that has buzz, you know, maybe get some, you know, recognition. But that shows that here are, I don't know, here are the 6 or 7 or 8 initiatives that we've taken on that we've proven can work. You can have an electric kitchen, and then maybe perhaps the electric kitchen lowers the temperature in the kitchen, and it actually makes the workplace a little bit nicer and a little bit easier for people. So you don't have so much turnover in cooks, and cooks actually feel a little bit like, oh, this is a workplace where I can stay. And one of the things we're doing with plastic, for example, we're not just removing plastic from the kitchen. We are not going to accept any deliveries from any companies that uses single-use plastic. So now we have to, it's about the supply chain. You can't give me a spice in those 1-pound plastic tubs. You can't wrap your meat in cryovac plastic. You can't give me milk in a plastic jug. That's a much, much bigger deal than just saying I'm going to take plastic straws out of my bar. And so if we can show you that roadmap and we can say, here, this is what it really costs to do that. Can we affect change? Can we have a few companies down the road that go, you know what, it's worth it. I'll create a new distribution supply chain system. You know, if we do this and we promote the company that's going to get rid of plastics in their supply chain, maybe 20 other restaurants start buying from them. Maybe they start getting some press. Maybe they start going, oh, this is worth it to do because we're getting new accounts and new clients because of this. And maybe the bigger corporations start to look at it and go, hey, we're losing 1% or 0.5% market share to this. That's the future. We should change too. If we can do that, if we can take one major company and change their supply chain, that to me is success.
I know I said I had 2 more questions, but I still have 2 more questions. Since we started talking about the Me Too movement and women in the restaurant industry, I know you have thoughts about how to run the new restaurant that concern women in the kitchen. So why don't you just talk about that for a minute or two?
Yeah, I mean, when we looked at every single, you know, and at least in the media, like with the Me Too movement, like, oh, if there was one woman in leadership, that shit wouldn't have happened. You have to have a diversified leadership system, and you typically actually don't even have those problems. No one's perfect, but I think just ensuring that you have voices in leadership in every part of the room we eliminate a lot of problems. No one is going to let that happen. You know, it, of course, like in the media, it was like the very extreme cases, but, you know, down to small things, like if you, you know, like I said, I came into the restaurant industry, I came from riverboat casinos in the South. So I'm sure you
awesome.
Can imagine.
I want to hear that story.
That was not ideal. But, you know, once I came back to Kentucky, Chef Annie Petri at DECA was one of my mentors. You know, she was a chef from San Francisco. And I remember when I had been trying to have a baby forever. And whenever I finally was pregnant, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to resign. And I was met with like, why would you resign? Like, here are some accommodations to help you in this industry. And like, let's create a roadmap and like, let's look at all the policies. And, you know, we were able to move forward. And I just think having different voices in the room that understand your experience are so important.
And I think too, you know, we agree, like when we say it's a woman-led kitchen, our goal is to not have 100% female gender in the, you know, it's like, it's a woman-led kitchen, but we also want diversity. We want diversity of people, genders, thought, ideas. We want all kinds of diversity.
Right. You're also talking about doing a sort of team-led kitchen as opposed to a strictly hierarchical kitchen. Well, I do have one more question, but first I want to thank you and, of course, wish you luck. And I have some follow-up ideas. I have to make sure I think they're right before I ask you about them, but certainly be following what you're doing.
And then we're gonna start a podcast and then interview you about your nonprofit project.
I swear to God, that's what I'm thinking. So like, maybe we'll just do that. We'll do it on our podcast. You interview me.
And we'll ask the questions.
But let me think about it.
All right.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's why we reached out to you is because of the, you know, I read an article in The Guardian about what you were doing and you immediately responded, which I was shocked by the way.
And it was so obvious to do. And I almost reached out 6 months or a year ago when I heard what you were up to, but something got in the way. I can't remember what, but.
And I know that, you know, a lot of things you're doing are not restaurateur focused. They're the person who is receiving the food. They're the eater, which is everyone. But, you know, I can't wait to look more into your model and discuss, you know, how we're, you know, what we're doing and what you're doing are very aligned. And I do believe that you also, you know, believe in like chef-driven meals or very good meals that you want to feed your family.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I think we have a lot of data to share with one another.
Right. We're on the same page on most stuff. I agree. Last question is, we ask everybody this, what'd you have for dinner last night? It's a bit of out of left field in this conversation, but what the hell?
So I actually hosted 8 women who run a direct aid feeding organization in Lexington, Kentucky that I've worked alongside with in relief. And it was a very big hodgepodge of my CSA box roasted veggies. And then I got some food from NAMI, Edward's new restaurant. And then some proteins that, you know, I had left over. And yeah, it was a beautiful time to actually, they were here on a retreat. So I was able to host them and it was lovely.
Sounds like a buffet.
It was definitely a buffet of things.
We do buffets a lot.
Yeah, there was a lot of like Korean curry and then also like very American leathery britches. So.
My wife and daughter were at a birthday party, so I got a rare moment to stay at home and not cook. So I ate leftover cold fried chicken with hot sauce and watched my Giants get completely obliterated by the Cowboys.
I'm so happy I didn't watch that game.
And I just turned it off at halftime, and that's it. That wasn't the best night.
Are you from New York?
I am. Brooklyn born.
We'll have to talk about that at some point.
What did you have for dinner?
I've become a complete red zone addict. So I watched, you know, whatever, 10 football games all afternoon. Really had fun. I mean, I missed it so much. So my partner, Kathleen, made nachos. So we had nachos with really good beef, tomato sauce I'd made the day before, good cheese, blah, 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 blah. But they were definitely nachos. And then we had ice cream and we were like, we shouldn't eat any more ice cream. It tastes so good, but it makes you feel bad.
Makes you feel so bad.
Yeah, like, let's not eat anymore. And we never buy it, but when people come stay at our house or come for dinner, whatever, they bring ice cream and then it's there, so we eat it. Yeah. All right. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Ciao. Bye.
Thank you again to Edward Lee and Lindsay off SASIC. I think what they're doing is terrific, and not just because it's somewhat similar to what I'm trying to do. I hope you agree, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Follow Edward on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, Chef Edward Lee. That's Chef Edward Lee, L-E-E. And follow Lindsay on Instagram, Lindsay off SASIC, LindseyOfCACK. You can also follow the Lee Initiative on Instagram at Lee Initiative. Thank you for listening. Thanks to my co-host and producer, Kate Bittman, and to our engineer, Davis Lloyd, as always. Thank you all for listening. And tune in next week when we will have somebody awesome. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.